Mom, please, Rod.
Thank you, be seated. I want to thank everyone for being here today. We have had a panel change, so we'll introduce the panel again to you. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. To my left is Justice Dana Womack. And I'm Bonnie Sutterth. I'm the Chief Justice of the Second Court of Appeals. We've received information that the attorneys have checked in. And if the clerk of the court will please call the case.
The court will now call Thomas Olivas versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Ms. Cynthia Orr to argue for the appellants, Mr. Joseph Spence to argue for the appellee. Sorry, the state.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Sutterth, Justice Kerr, and Justice Womack, colleagues, counsel. I represent Thomas Olivas with Abbasi Major from my office. On the state's brief at pages 22 and 23, remarkably, the state says, however, exclusion is warranted in this case based on the officer's conduct and the purpose of the exclusionary rule. Your Honors, this has been sent back down by the Court of Criminal Appeals after the Carpenter holding to decide that very question. Here, we had no application by the state for 28 days of CLSI, that is, historic cell tower data, in February, an application for 5 hours on March 20th, and an application for 20 days, March 1 through March 22. That's 50 days total. I am certain that the state utilized 21 days of data based on their use of a February 9 going forward period in this period for which no application was sought to determine whether or not Mr. Olivas had visited the area with the tower at the Rack Daddy location that also encompassed the President Court address where the decedent was killed. The Supreme Court tells us that when privacy yields to search is to be decided by a judicial officer, not the police or the government. And by breaking this up in pieces, I'll suggest to the court what we have is the police or the government deciding that matter. In Carpenter, even though first two days of data was obtained, and thereafter 120 some odd days of data, the court considered the sum total of CLSI obtained. And footnote 3 in the Carpenter case is very key. It's the first time I've seen a holding of the Supreme Court in a footnote. But the court in that footnote hold that at least we have a search when we have 7 days of data seized. But in addition, contrary to Justice Kennedy's dissent, the Supreme Court said we don't hold that less than that is not a search. We just are deciding this case before us now. However, it's clear that less than 7 days certainly reveals the privacies of life, and quite frankly, here where the state used at least 21 days of data, we know that we've got that. Where they seized 50 days of data, we know we have a search in each occasion. And the state concedes as much with regard to the February data that they obtained without any application or warrant, and they concede that with regard to the second application for the March 1 through 22 period that I'm not certain they used any of except the March 20 date. In addition,
from the data that they gathered, what was the state able to prove at trial that they otherwise would not be able to prove at trial?
Well, using this substantial amount of data, what they were able to prove, and the reason we have harm, Your Honor, is contrary to the suggestion that this is somehow cumulative of material they obtained from Mr. Olivas during his post-Miranda interview, we have a chart at 22 and 23 of our reply brief that sets out what Mr. Olivas said in his interview and how this information was used by Officer Sedgwick from the CLSI that impeached what Mr. Olivas said. So on every occasion, it wasn't cumulative, it was impeaching and contradictory. But to spell it out by facts, what we had is that Mr. Olivas was saying when he was in the Arlington area using the Rack Daddy Tower where he had worked for 4 months, where the president's address also used that tower. And the Agent Sedgwick was saying, no, you weren't there at that time when you said you were. And quite frankly, at page 41 of State's Exhibit 6, the agent interviewing Mr. Olivas says, you know, if we determine that you're lying about any of these facts, you're going to look guilty. That's at page 42 of that exhibit. So that was the whole point of this CLSI. They used it for the effect of showing, no, you weren't where you said you were when you told us you were there. You were there in Arlington using that Rack Daddy Tower longer than you said you were, so you were there at the window of time, placing him there during the period of time that they said that the decedent was killed, that he was lying about that. Really powerful impeachment information and impactful. And we don't have to guess, Your Honors, whether or not this had an effect on the verdict, because jury note number one was, give us the CSLI. Give us Sedgwick's testimony. Give us the maps that he used, some 14 maps from some 104 pages of testimony, and some 12 pages of the state's argument. The first thing the jury asked for was give us that cell tower data information. So the state cannot meet its burden of proving that this had no effect on the verdict beyond a reasonable doubt.
But in his interview, he admitted that he was at the general area the crime during the relevant time when the crime occurred.
Thank you for asking that question, Chief. What he did admit was after the agent told him in State's Exhibit 6 at pages 5 and 7, you were at the area where this offense occurred, and you were at that area during the time that it occurred. He then asks him at page 9, now, you see why I can't exclude you. And he says, well, sure. And he says, well, why? And it's like what you said. He repeats, because you say I'm in the area and near the around the period of time that this offense occurred. I didn't know it before, but now that you've told me, I can see why you can't clear me. So it's pretty clear he's not saying, yes, I know when the murder occurred and I know where. And this tower is literally in the parking lot of the Rack Daddies where he had worked for 4 months. Whether it was really close in time, this offense, he doesn't reveal his work dates, but at volume one of the clerk's record at page...
But doesn't he say that he was driving around?
Yes, he did. Yes. And he doesn't deny Justice Sudreth that he was going to meet or planned to meet the decedent that evening. No doubt about that. No doubt about that.
And didn't he text her, though, shortly after 10 p.m. and said he didn't have a car?
He did, and he also explained in that same interview at State's Exhibit 6 that what he was indicating is he had to return the car to the person he was borrowing from, and so he couldn't have an overnight stay. He told her, I've got to get back and get this car returned to, I think, Miss Rowe is who he borrowed it from. So although the text didn't explain all that, I don't have a car, that's what he meant by that, and he explained that in his initial interview. So with regard to no harm, since we were on that topic, and then I'll get back to the carbon.
You asked us to read or to look at the record in a light where he was just parroting what the investigator was telling him about being at the scene at the time.
Yes, Your Honor.
But aren't we supposed to, under the Jackson standard, view it in light most favorable?
No, Chief Justice Sudreth, that's a wonderful question. Typically, that's the case on appeal. But here, where we're looking at harm with regard to the state's burden to show it had no effect on the verdict beyond a reasonable doubt, the court reviews this in a neutral light. The Love case is very clear on that out of the Court of Criminal Appeals in our brief. So you look at it in a neutral light, Your Honor. And so with regard to the harm, what was the strength of the state's case? There was no evidence that Mr. Olivas was at this women's apartment, no eyewitness that saw him. They saw a beefy hooded figure they couldn't even tell the gender and race of outside the apartment. No DNA that, by the way, he volunteered to provide Although there's a much heyday about the scratches on his body, there's none of her his DNA under her fingernails, but some other male's DNA under her fingernails. There's none of her blood on him, even though this was a bloody stabbing, very, very much bloodshed on walls, and if you view the crime scene photos. Her wallet was stolen. It was missing from the scene. That's found nowhere on him. That there's no accelerant found in the vehicle, even though there's as much ado about gas. Well, the fire marshal used the scientific testing to test it and found no gas accelerant in that lone vehicle. He consented the search of his phone, the contents of his phone only. It says iPhone 8G, not the CLSI stored elsewhere. That Carpenter, at page 20 of the slip opinion, says it's not stored on the phone. His car, he had consented to the search of his DNA, handed over his clothing, his hands, his shoes. There's no traffic cameras that show him anywhere near there. There's no gas station cameras showing him anywhere near the apartments. There's no proof he knew of the address, although the state really looked hard for it. And there's no proof that he asked for a false alibi from anyone. That's record one, clerk's record one, page 134 in the Brady disclosure by the state. So it's a pretty, and no evidence that he bought any gun or any other weapon. So it's a very weak case in that regard. It's really not remarkable he's in the area. That Rack Daddy's is very close using the, in fact, the tower's in the parking lot to Rack Daddy's. And his bail application, or his request for indigency to have appointed counsel shows that he worked at that Rack Daddy's. So, I don't know that he'd be sophisticated enough to know that that tower in the Rack Daddy's billiards parking lot, where he was known to be a gamer, would be the same tower used for the apartment some almost mile away on President's Court Drive. With regard to the holdings in Carpenter, we also know, in addition to footnote 3, that hold it's at least 7 days and possibly less. They haven't decided that, as they clearly state in the footnote. Carpenter also holds at page 2222 that the Fourth Amendment protection extends to a detailed log of a person's movements over several years, and there they're talking about the fact all this data is retained on all of us for 5 years. And what makes this different from pinging, like in Sims, and the GPS, as in the Jones case, is this is stored for 5 years on all of us, regardless of whether we've done anything wrong or suspected of anything. And that prior to this, police could obtain it without any showing of probable cause or wrongdoing on our part, without any idea of who or when they might want to search that information. And this is why the Supreme Court held that these privacies of life are protected, but also because these are the understandings of our founders at the time that the Fourth Amendment was enacted. The court also said that when we have a search for evidence of crime, and here in the applications it's clear, there's no exigency. They've already found the child by the time they apply for this information. Mr. Olivas is not considered armed or danger to the community in any way. None of that is mentioned in any of the record. And in fact, he is not. They find him peaceably. But the Supreme Court says when you're looking for evidence of crime, then warrantless searches are typically unreasonable at 2221 of the opinion. And what the court does is they track back to those founding era understandings. And Boyd in 1886, which they go through this through pages 22, 14, and 15 of the opinion, they say that they have considered 1886 that we secure the privacies of our life against arbitrary power. In D. Reed, 1948, we protect against excessive permeating surveillance. In 1967, protect private conduct done in public places. That's the telephone booth case. In Knotts, an expectation of privacy in our physical location and movements once we go into a private place, the beeper, until the guy goes into his cabin. In Kylo, we preserve a degree of privacy existing when the Fourth Amendment was adopted against advancing technology. That was the thermal imaging from outside the home, and in Joe's, the right to privacy in our public movements. If with my few seconds remaining, I'll say that I did preserve all error. There's no waiver because at trial, the trial counsel moved to suppress all CSI records at one clerk's record 113. The court acknowledges an objection by counsel to all CSLI records at 16 record 5 lines 4 through 7. In the appeal brief, I talk about the 21 days I mentioned of utilized CSI and request suppression of all that the state obtained at pages 21, 22, 26, and 31 of my brief. And I, if the court has any other questions, let me see what else I wanted to say to the court. I will also say that the state relies in its reply brief on Ford, that was one of my cases before the Court of Criminal Appeals, that has been overruled by Carpenter. Since that case relied upon the Fifth Circuit case in Ray U.S. application for CLSI, which was expressly overruled by Carpenter, it's clear that Ford's been overruled. This short court should not rely upon it for any purpose. The bottom line in this case, justices, is that law enforcement can easily get this information. They simply need to use a warrant. With regard to, I mentioned exigency. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Joe Spence for the state. I would like to acknowledge my co-counsel couldn't be here this morning, but Tori Ford helped with the brief, and I just wanted to acknowledge her.
Could you raise that microphone a bit? There you go.
Is that better?
I think so.
Okay. I'll try to.
I'm not in the back of the room, but I think it's a little better.
Okay. Very good. I think ultimately this case is probably going to end up in a harmless error analysis, but I say that with a caveat. For 2 points. One, we did raise in our brief an issue about the judge's ruling on the motion to suppress, and I believe the judge entered what I call a conditional ruling, which I don't think was challenged on appeal on remand, and that conditional ruling had to do with, at the time the judge said, look, Fifth Circuit has ruled that you don't need a warrant. The defendant appellant was arguing at the time, well, we think the state constitution, Article 1, Section 9, affords greater protection than the Fourth Amendment. And the judge said, I disagree. But in the event that we go upstairs and it's determined or questioned whether you are protected and a warrant was required, the judge ruled, I think that you have essentially waived it or consented to this for the CSLI without a warrant, because you no longer have an expectation of privacy based on the statements that the defendant made to the detectives. And again, without even getting to the merits of that ruling, that was a ground on the motion to suppress for the judge's ruling. And that's found in volume 3, page 20 through 29. And our point is, on remand, we believe that conditional ruling became ripe once this issue of potential warrant requirement in Carpenter and it being sent back to this court, that was something on remand they should have raised. And we cite the Copeland case with the proposition that if you don't attack all of the grounds that support the order denying the motion to suppress, that you forfeit your right to challenge it. So, but with that, the other caveat as to how or why we apply harmless error really turns to one of the, I think, primary points we make in our brief, and that is there were two separate Stored Communications Act applications. The very first one asked for 5 hours of CSLI from 7 p.m. until 11:59, almost midnight p.m., on the day of the murder. And what we know is that from the record, Michelle Gandy was alive at least until about 10 minutes after 9 p.m. that evening. We know that because there was a testimony from a witness named Lana Murphy who said she spoke with Michelle Gandy about that time. What we know is the first 911 call was at 10:10 p.m. So really the focus on that evening of when we know from the record Michelle Gandy was alive a little after 9 and by 10:10 they were calling 911 and the apartment was on fire. So I bring that up simply from the standpoint of our first request for CSLI asked for CSLI from 7 p.m. to, again, till midnight on the evening of the murder. It's our contention that even in light of Carpenter, that that request was not a Fourth Amendment search. And here's why we say that, and I think you have to go back to the Ford case, Court of Criminal Appeals here in Texas. You have to filter your way, I think, through Carpenter. And then there's a case that came out last month, Sims versus State. And in Sims versus State, and by the way, I'll backtrack. In Ford, the Court of Criminal Appeals said 4 days of CSLI is not enough to constitute a Fourth Amendment search, and thus the Fourth Amendment isn't implicated. That was pre-Carpenter. It's interesting in Ford, when they ruled or held that, in the very paragraph, they noted in Ford, we anticipate, knowing that there were cases pending in the U.S. Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court may very well in the future conclude that long-term CSLI, long-term electronic surveillance, might require a warrant and implicate the Fourth Amendment. But Ford held 4 days did not. So we moved to Carpenter. There's footnote 3 in Carpenter, because Carpenter had two searches. One search was 127 days worth of CSLI, and they were tracing the defendant all around Ohio for a number of robberies that occurred. But one of the requests, they asked it for 7 days, and they only got 2 days from that request. But the footnote 3 says the parties wanted to agree that anything less than 7 days would not be a Fourth Amendment search and subject to Fourth Amendment restraints. The Supreme Court really just left it at that. They said that's what they want. We don't need to decide that, but we will say that 7 days is enough to implicate the Fourth Amendment. So we move forward to Sims in this year, Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. There they used 3 hours of real-time CSI as opposed to historical CSLI. Real-time, they tracked an individual's phone because they were fleeing up into Oklahoma. Here's what Sims ruled. They went through Carpenter. They noted in Carpenter, look, you know, the third-party doctrine is dead, more or less. But we still have this CATS expectation of privacy issue. And they said, we do not think that, first they said, real-time CSLI is no different than historical. And in footnote 15, they specifically explained that, said we do not treat it for Carpenter purposes as any different. And then they said 3 hours of CSLI is not enough because no one would have an expectation of privacy in just 3 hours of CSLI, and we have 5 here in our first application. What's interesting, and counsel admitted this idea of, well, that is intrusive into the privacies of life, and where that comes from, Carpenter mentions it, but it comes from Jones in 2012. Scalia wrote the majority, but Justice Sotomayor wrote a concurrence, and in there she said, you know, this electronic surveillance issue, we've had this trespass theory of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence for a long time, and this may not be any sort of physical intrusion or trespass with electronic surveillance, but we have CATS, and CATS added to, didn't replace, this trespass theory under the law. And of course, CATS is the two-prong, reasonable expectation of privacy, subjective and objective components. And in that situation, here's what Sotomayor said. She said, look, we envisioned that long-term electronic surveillance could in fact invade the privacies of life, and she labeled that familial, political, professional, religious, and sexual associations. And then she went down a list and said, for instance, will they know if you've visited a psychiatrist or a plastic surgeon or an abortion clinic or a strip club or the by-the-hour motel, or you've went and visited a criminal attorney, or were you at a union meeting, or a mosque, or a synagogue, or a church, or a gay bar. And the point she was trying to make there is at some point, this electronic surveillance, especially with CSLI, because remember, CSLI isn't the contents of the phone itself. It's simply stored by the carrier and shows the location of the cell tower that a phone was pinging. It's a location issue. And so she said that, look, long-term CSLI may in fact invade these privacies of life. And so our first application in the 5 hours between 7 p.m. and midnight on the evening of the murder, right in the time when the murder occurred, It's our position it was not subject to Fourth Amendment, and therefore you can't overlay a harmless error analysis on those 5 hours because it was an error to admit CSLI of those 5 hours. But go ahead.
If we do hold that all the CSLI is out the window, would you agree that probably its admission was harmful in light of how much the state focused on it in presenting its case?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't. And here's why. I mean, that's a question the court's going to have to address, and I don't believe so here, and here's why. And in our brief, as we got into the harmless error analysis, we had a footnote, I think a conditional sort of argument that said, look, even if the court believes that all the CSLI required a warrant, I think we have to look first at what was the CSLI that was utilized, because harmless error requires an analysis. Even if it was error under the Fourth Amendment to get it, harmless error requires an analysis of did the improperly admitted evidence contribute to the conviction? Well, if CSLI was just admitted and never used, never discussed, which most of it falls into that category, I think none of that could contribute to the conviction. And so because of that, there was Exhibit 285, which contained February 1 through February 28 of 2011, CSLI on the appellant's phone. That was never discussed, save and except one phone call that was near the victim's apartment. And they tried to use that to show that he was out and about with his mistress. But other than that, it was never, Agent Sedgwick is our FBI expert from our brief, if you've read that. He never really mentioned any of that. The March 1 through March 22, he never mentioned any of that in his report, save and except 14 hours of CSLI beginning about 2 p.m. on the day of the murder and extending to 5:47 a.m. the day after the murder. That's all that Sedgwick focused on. Okay, so that's our first point, is that's what you have to look at, I think, in any harmless error analysis.
But what if the suppression motion was granted and there was no CSLI in the case at all? Mm-hmm. It wasn't admitted, obviously it wouldn't be mm-hmm. testified about. Do you think you could have gotten a conviction?
Yes, absolutely. And we cite the Ramos case in our brief that talks about, would the jury verdict have been any different absent the erroneously admitted CSLI, if we're under that hypothetical? And they say that's the test, and they talk about, did the erroneously admitted evidence move a jury from a position of non-persuasion to a position of persuasion? That's another test, because contribute to the conviction is somewhat amorphous. And so these cases kind of say, this is how you decide that. But here's our position. There is nothing in the interviews that was detailed by, or the detailed interviews the day after the murders of the appellant, where he admitted essentially all of the location information. And again, I have to remind the court, CSLI is not what's on your phone per se. So the fact that the appellant may have called someone at a certain time and who the appellant called, or vice versa, he received a call or sent a text message at what time to whom, and we have the content of those text messages, none of that is CSLI. All CSLI is the latitude and longitude of a given call or text, or sometimes a data if you're searching data, of the cell tower that the phone was closest to and was pinging. And from that, Agent Sedgwick creates this pie wedge or area and says that phone is somewhere in this area. And of course, his testimony was it was within a half mile, 0.7 mile at these relevant times of the apartment where Michelle Gandy lived. But here's what Olivas said in his interview. He said at Sunday at 2 p.m. he went to Volcanoes in Hearst, Texas. He said he played a golf game called Golden Tee. By the way, that was corroborated because they got the Golden Tee machine records and showed he was there playing. He admitted he had his phone the whole day and was texting back and forth and calling Michelle Gandy. So we know his phone was with him by his own admission. He said he texted Michelle while he was at Volcanoes. He admitted he was going to meet her later in Arlington. He said he left Hearst, Texas at about 7 p.m., came down 360 to Airport Freeway 360 to Lamar, and started heading east on Lamar toward Collins. One of the things that the other side has made a big deal of, and we did, I admit we did use this, we tried to impeach him on the idea that he said he left Volcanoes and Hearst at 7 p.m. The cell records seem to show that the location of his phone, he really left around 6. Did we make a huge deal of that? No. In fact, in closing argument, our prosecutor said, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. He was probably drinking all day. He probably doesn't really remember. Now, again, that was a sidebar remark, and the other side told him to quit it. But at the end of the day, we didn't view that as the end-all, be-all impeachment. And the reason why, it goes back to whether he left Hearst at 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. is not particularly relevant to, we know this murder happened between 9 p.m. and 10 p.m., and that's when his phone shows he was in the area right by the apartment. But he admitted that in his interviews. And in fact, I know that counsel tried to downplay this a little bit, but here's even what he said. Not only did he admit that he was in this area, he said, I was right off Collins and Lamar, which her apartment is in the northwest quadrant of Collins and Lamar. He said, I was around there the whole evening till 10:07, or he said till 10. The detective said, so knowing right now, I can't exclude you. I'm telling you that up front, okay? He says, yeah, I know. And you understand why? And he says, absolutely, sir. Do you really understand? He says, no, I understand. And he says, well, can you just, I know you understand. Can you basically tell me? And he says, I just finish reading
you can
this?
Finish the sentence.
It says, because I put myself at the scene of the crime or in the area, that's why. So our position is it truly was harmless error if all said 14 hours were allowed to be heard by the jury, and therefore we ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I'll start with Mr. Spence ended, and that was, that's the what you told me answer that Mr. Spence just read to you. If you look at the previous pages 4 and 7 of the interview, the officer is telling him, you were there. That's close to where the offense was committed. And then said, I want you to understand why I can't, because he's providing that information to Mr. Olivas. It's not an admission by him.
Was he told in the interview that they knew that because of CSLI?
No, because at that time, Your Honor, they didn't have that. But he said that we can tell where you've been by your phone, the GPS on your phone, can we search it? And Mr. Olivas said, yes, you can search my phone, but it's clear in the written consent form and in the words used that it's the contents of his phone, not CSLI. All right. And then, again, I'll commend to the court the chart about
so at most that was trickery. They really didn't know he was there.
That's right, Your Honor.
But the police are allowed to use that in interrogation.
That's correct, Chief Justice. Okay. And then the chart at pages 22 and 23 that goes item by item about all the ways that they impeach Mr. Olivas's testimony and, he did not testify, his statements during the interview, and they tell him, States Exhibit 5, page 42, you need to let us know because any deception from you today is going to be something. We're going to let the DA office know. And if we find out this, you tell us this, and the truth, well, it's something else. It's like the 48 Hours show and those TV shows. Well, he's lying to us about this, but we don't really know why, so it makes him look guilty. So the jury heard that as well, that this impeachment they were giving to the jury about everything that Mr. Olivas said is in his interview, blow by blow, hour by hour, time, place, and et cetera, was significant because as it was telling the jury he's lying. This wasn't focused on, the testimony was, and so look at the defendant's phone records, and he's pinging off the tower less than a mile away from the decedent's house at 2:18 a.m., and guess to where he was and what he's doing. Lies. He lied about how he got to Arlington and how long he stayed there. He told the detective he left at 9:30-ish. Lie. The message of pinging at a tower from 10:07. He said, oh, he was only there for an hour and a half tops. A lie. He's in Arlington at 6:15 all the way up to 10:07 and later says, maybe I left between 9:45 and 10. Again, a lie. This is stringing the testimony. Again, 7:10 to 9:22. You don't have more backing bounce and forth. His phone is pinging solely on the wedge that includes the apartment, the murder location. And They don't say he's around there. He says he is now at Michelle's apartment at page 34 of our brief, 20 volume of the record, page 13, lines 1 through 5. He is now at Michelle's apartment. In argument, I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the text which was sent was handed by the tower that includes the decedent's apartment and was essentially from the parking lot as he's driving away, placing him not in the area, but directly at the scene. With regard to waiver, again, I'll point out to the court, Ford has been overruled. I know it was my case, it hurt. But in addition, the court in Carpenter says Justice Kennedy is wrong to say that searches less than 7 days are not a search under the Fourth Amendment. We're just deciding this case before us now, and then the court there compiled all that was requested, not was what was used. And we had one production. Sorry.
What about the state's argument that really, because they split up their requests into two pieces, that if we just focus on the first request for 5 hours worth, that didn't need a warrant?
I think, Your Honor, that the court, that's why I'm focusing on footnote 3, because the Supreme Court didn't say that. That amounts less. It still reveals the privacies of life. And
so,
this is
so is there, I mean, do you have a time period to suggest that, I mean, are Do you
I think
there should be some sort of bright line test?
I think
for this?
The time that a difference is this way, Your Honor. In the real time search in Sims where they're pinging, they only had 5 location points at most during the 3 hours. And it's different. It's real time. It's not every minute you're moving around your phone, movement by movement, like historic CLSI is. They actually send out a request ping, where is he now? And you get that finite location on that one occasion. So Sims is very different from this case. It's
but
very discreet.
Sims, do you disagree with Mr. Spence's characterization that Sims said there's really no distinction to be drawn between real time and historical?
I absolutely disagree. I think there's a major distinction. That's why the Court of Criminal Appeals remanded this and decided Sims. There's a terribly great difference, and the Supreme Court spends a great deal of time describing that difference, and I'll submit references to those parts of the opinion on a post-submission brief for the court's convenience.
Thank you. Well, we thank you so much for your argument. It's been very helpful to us today. And this will conclude our arguments for the day. Your case has been submitted.